And thanks to the planning committee for the invitation. I've been asked to cover the National Beef Quality Audit with you in 1 hour. The original slide deck is about 350 slides. I've narrowed that just a tad. So what I will tell you in advance is that the proceedings paper that you have is a short summary of both the cow and bull and the fed steer and heifer results. And so you have that on your USB jump drive that you got at registration. And if you need more information, I will show you how to get that at the end of the presentation. So to set it up, to kind of guide you a little bit, you'll see that fed steer and heifer is in blue for a reason, and market cow and bull is in red for a reason. When you see that sidebar color change, that's when I'm changing from fed steer and heifer to cow and bull, but I will preface that in the presentation as well. So first of all, let's set the stage on why we've done the National Beef Quality Audit for 25 years. And so that's what the 2016 audit was kind of this 25-year snapshot of where we've come from the original 1991 audit. If you look back in terms of why that audit was originally done, a paper was done by Chuck Lambert in 1990 into 91, that said we were losing about $458 a head in the beef industry due to lost opportunities or quality defects. And so that stemmed to the original 1991 National Fed Beef Quality Audit. That was followed with a Fed Steer and Heifer Audit in 95, 2000, 2005, 2012, and now 2016. We also realized there was this big piece of cows and bulls and being marketed in the industry, and that is a fairly large beef supply that wasn't being evaluated with that original audit. So in 1994, the National Market Cow and Bull Audit was started, and that was also followed in 1999 and then 2007 and now 2016. So we have 25 years worth of history that we can look at and see where we've come. Every audit that's been done has been done in three phases. The first phase is face-to-face interviews, working with our end users, trying to figure out what their input is on quality defects that they're seeing and what their customers are saying. So that's going to include packers, purveyors, retail, restaurateurs, further processors, and that group of individuals, along with government agencies. We also have phase two, being the in-plant audits, which I'll get to, and then phase three, the strategy workshop of trying to summarize that information to a take-home message for producers. So first, face-to-face interviews. So we interviewed 36 packers, 35 retail, 29 food service, 64 further processors, and also some government and trade associations to try to figure out what they're hearing. When we look at those individuals, we captured about 92% of all animals harvested on the beef side, so that'd be market cows and bulls and fed steers and heifers, about 55% of the retail market. And food service is a little harder to estimate because a lot of them wouldn't tell us exact volume of beef purchased. So we're estimating about 25% of the food service market. When we did this in a series of questions. The first question was, how do you define certain quality factors, or what we termed buckets, for your company? And so we had seven buckets we identified: how and where cattle are raised, lean, fat, and bone, weight and size, visual characteristics, food safety, eating satisfaction, and cattle genetics. And we asked them, what do those terms mean to your company? And if you want to see all seven, you can go to the full executive summary. But I've chosen just a few of those for you for interest of time. So if we first look at food safety for fed steers and heifers. So if those individuals bought fed steer and heifer beef, we said, what does the term food safety mean to you relative to that beef product that you're buying from fed steers and heifers? And time again, what you see is that it's critical, it's pathogen-free, it's produced in a safe environment, critical to the business, top priority, wholesome, critically important, and so you get the message. One retailer said foodborne illness is the first thing that will shut us down, especially if there's a death, and I will pick suppliers based on that. I don't want to risk a foodborne illness. And we heard that type of phrase time and time again from retail and food service. If you go to eating satisfaction, another trait on the fed steer and heifer side, customer satisfaction is the number one response across the board in terms of what that means. If you break that down, that's tenderness and flavor, to those groups. Now you realize tenderness is more important than flavor, except with food service. If you expand on that just a little bit, our food service operator said, you know, consumers typically know what they're going to expect if they come to a Ruth's Chris versus a sirloin stockade. But it has to have good flavor or they're not going to come back. So they know what they can expect on tenderness based on where they go. It's the flavor that we have to be able to control. And so that's why they specified that flavor was probably more important than tenderness for food service. When we look at the cow and bull side, if we take one trait of how and where cattle are raised, what that meant to them was source location, geography, animal welfare, geography, production practices is thrown in there, as well as animal well-being. I will preface that by telling you that a lot of food service and retail groups tended not to really know what kind of beef they were buying. And so they had mixed comments, mixed expectations. Some said we're buying all cow and bull beef when you know based on what they're selling, that's not true. But nonetheless, it gives us an opportunity for education. The second set of questions to this group was, based on these seven buckets, is there a must-have, meaning is there a trait in those seven that you have to have before you'll buy the product? Or are there some areas where you might see a potential where you'd be willing to pay a premium if we could guarantee that we could meet a demand for that definition? So you have to go back to how they define those traits. If we look at these answers, so we compared these to what the answers were in the 2012 audit. And so we don't have a comparison on the cow and bull side because this has never been done with cows and bulls like this. But the green arrows mean that more of those groups have a must-have for that trait. So there are more packers that have a must-have, meaning they have some requirement of their producers relative to how and where cattle are raised. There's some requirements for lean, fat, and bone, and so on and so forth. But probably what you're more interested in is, yes, there's some must-haves and there's been some changes, but there's more individuals, more companies and organizations willing to pay a premium for those traits as well. And so if you look at the arrows, almost all of them are green. And so if we look at, for example, eating satisfaction, 55% of our packers are willing to pay a premium if we can guarantee eating satisfaction, 84% of retailers and 56% of food service operators, if you can guarantee that. Now, you have to guarantee how they defined it, so you have to go back to those original definitions. The next question we always get is, well, what percent premium? All those percentages have gone down since the 2012 audit, but still, a 10% premium in eating satisfaction isn't that bad if you can guarantee it. And so there are some opportunities for us to improve those traits as we go through time. The last set of questions was really relative importance. So how would you rank those seven buckets? Is there a bucket that's more important than another when we look to rank those seven? When we look at first fed steers and heifers, by far, the number one response, really the numbers aren't important, it's the order of the numbers. So the larger the number, the more important that trait. Food safety is by and far the most important trait in fed steer and heifer beef in all groups. The second most important, before I jump to cows and bulls, second most important across all groups is eating satisfaction. When you go to cows and bulls, you end up being a little bit more across the board. So food safety is still important, but the second most important will vary upon group. Packers say that lean, fat, and bone is second most important. Retailers say visual characteristics, especially if they're going to put that product in a retail case where you have to deal with color issues on that product. Food service also say, and further processors also say lean, fat, and bone. There was also, so if you look at a collaborative, so take out who responded and just throw it across all the respondents in phase one, steers and heifers, food safety is first most important, eating satisfaction is second. When you look at cows and bulls, food safety is most important, and then second becomes lean, fat, and bone. We're going to throw in a producer component to that a little bit later so you can see how that relates as well. We also asked about strengths. What's the strength of the beef industry? On the fed steer and heifer side, by and far, it's product quality. And you heard that mentioned when we talked about price and demand and those types of issues this morning, that quality was important. When you look at cows and bulls, it's a little more sporadic in terms of the strengths. Some say product quality, some say value. We had some food service say that they don't buy U.S. beef from the cow and bull plants. So it is a mix. We also were able to ask about terms that maybe we don't necessarily know how everyone defines. So animal welfare being one of those. How does those that are buying cow and bull beef, how do they define animal well-being? animal welfare and handling, welfare and handling, welfare and handling, welfare and handling. And so they have a tendency to define it the same. One packer said, treating animals with dignity and respect through the life cycle. That's how they define animal well-being. The last question we kind of asked was, do you require your suppliers to participate in a live animal quality assurance program? And so those that said yes, we had 15 packers, 14 retail and 8 food service, 21 further processors said, yes, we do. The thing that caught us off guard is that none of them could mention, not none, very few of them mentioned beef quality assurance as that program. So if they said yes, we asked what program. Our expectation was that they would mention the beef quality assurance program. They mentioned traits of programs, but they couldn't tell us what they were called. And so if you look at this don't know or other, they just called it something different. And so that does give us a piece of information to go forward with in terms of a thing that we can do relative to educating those further up the cycle, relative to what we do in production agriculture. If we compare these results of phase one back to what we've seen in previous audits, and granted they were done in a little bit different light, in 1991, the face-to-face interviews focused a lot on fat and palatability. And you can see that now we've kind of put those in their own bucket. Those are just the top six. If you go further down the list, you also see things like injection site lesions and brands and those types of issues in the top 10. Now, we've done the same type of system for the last two Fed audits, and you can see that the ranking and how those things are important and how those change. And so you can get a true sense of how things have been guided for the end users over time. We also do have some producer input. So with the help of NCBA and sending it to the state affiliates, we have 809 producer respondents. You can see the categories they represent, asking them the same types of questions. When we look at how producers in the dark red and our phase one interviews in the lighter shade of orange respond, you'll see the disconnect. And so if we look first at steers and heifers, if you look at those that are responding to steers and heifers, they say that weight and size is the most important. Why do producers say weight and size is the most important? Because you're paid on weight. And so we understand that. The second most important was food safety. And so we found that second one that matched. If you remind yourself from phase one, we said that food safety was most important, followed by eating satisfaction. Cows and bulls, those that are in producing cows and bulls and selling cows and bulls, they did say food safety is number one, most important, followed by eating satisfaction. We see food safety being the most important, but then we went down to lean, fat, and bone relative to eating satisfaction on the cow and bull side. So some key takeaways from phase one, some things that I'm throwing on here that maybe are in the rest of the data set that I didn't share with you. One, branded beef program use has increased, and so we do see more and more end users having some type of branded beef program, even if it's an internal store type program. Producers and processing, retail, food service, all of our end users define genetics very differently. Our end users define it as a color. So maybe that doesn't surprise you, but my guess is if I were to ask you to define genetics, you're going to have a very different definition for me. Consistency in size is more important than the increase in size. You're going to see the increase in size that we've seen over time here in a few minutes. And producers, I'll tell you that retail and food service, they've given in to having smaller product. They said, you know what? We can deal with an increase in size if you can give us a consistent box. So if packers can figure out how to sort, so we have 15 to 17 pound ribeyes, and every ribeye is 15 to 17 pounds, so we can know how we're going to cut that product and sell it to a consumer, we can deal with it. But it's when we have 12-pound and 20-pound ribeyes in the same box that we have a challenge. And so they've demonstrated to us verbally in the strategy workshop that that consistency in a box and consistency is more important. Food safety did dominate our discussion of relative importance and willingness to pay. Eating satisfaction is customer satisfaction, further defined as tenderness and flavor. And traceability is defined differently by what the topic is, whether it's food safety, marketing, or animal health. One of the last takeaways I want to talk about and refocus on is this term of beef quality assurance, and that no one outside of production really knows what that's about. Now, I will say more Packers are becoming aware as we involve more Packer partners on the BQA advisory board, but we need to take that message further down the chain as well. So on to phase two, the implant surveys. So first I'm going to do fed steers and heifers. This gives you a snapshot of where we went. When we were in a plant, we were in a plant for an entire day's production, so one shift or two, depending on the plant, to look at anywhere from 10% to 50% of the production, depending on where we were at in the plant. For the first time, we have some transportation data. So looking at 10% of the trucks received that day in the plant, how much time did they travel, distance traveled, number of cattle in the load, trailer dimensions, and allotted area per head. And so when we look at, just to give you an average and a kind of a range, anywhere from 0.2 hours to 12 hours on a truck is where those fed steers and heifers are coming from. So anywhere from 8 to 870 miles is how long those are being transported. Trailer dimensions, you can see, but we use that to calculate an area allotted per head. On average, we're allowing 12.2 square feet. If you look at this chart, which is very small to read, I know you probably can't see that in the back. These are the NAMI guidelines, so the North American Meat Institute guidelines for animal handling and space allocation. And basically it says that we should be providing a 1,000-pound hornless animal 12 square feet in transportation space. So we are giving, on average, the amount of space that a 1,000-pound animal should have on a truck. We have carcasses that weigh more than that, that you're going to see in here in a few minutes. And so we're probably a little bit shy on the amount of space allowed. We also were able to do, being out in the holding pen, some mobility scoring. And so each one of those trucks, scoring them for mobility as they came off the truck and headed to the scale. The good news is almost 97% of those cattle were scored a one, which is no issue. They move easily, not a problem. A two is minor stiffness. But think about this, some of those animals were hauled 870 miles. We only have 3% that are scored a two. If you travel 870 miles, are you going to move freely and easily when you start to move as well? Right? If you drove or if you flew, some of you, I don't think anybody raised their hand that they rode their horse. But if you drove straight through here for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 hours or flew to get here, were you freely moving as you got out of your car or your truck, right? So it's no different than with animals. 0.1% were classified as a three, so there was some minor stiffness and minor issues. No downers and no fours. When we were in the holding pens, we did all that when we were in the holding pens. On the harvest floor, we looked at things like animal ID, horns. I'm not going to present all the data to you. I'm just going to do a snapshot. We have 96% with identification on the harvest floor, and an increase in those with individual visual identification tags. So while we have a decrease in those that have ID, we have an increase in those that are individually identified. Hide color, always of interest, 58% on the harvest floor were black-hided, 20% were Holsteins. That's going to have an impact here as I get to cooler data. And then we go into bruises. So this is a frequency of carcasses without bruises. That has declined since the most previous fed beef audit from 77 to 61%. The good news is most of those are animals with a single bruise. So the remaining 39%, 28% of them have one, 8% had two, and 8% had two bruises, 2% had three bruises on that carcass. So we do have some bruise issues to worry about. The good news is, if there's a good news on that many carcasses having bruises, 77% of those are minimal, meaning they require less than a pound of trim on the harvest floor. So all those bruises will be trimmed. When you get to a critical and an extreme level, that's when we're impacting the value of that primal and going into that muscle tissue. Bruise location, you'll see a third of those are on the loin. Almost a third of those on the round, and the rest of them are spread almost evenly. There was a lot of talk when we presented this at the NAMI conference in Kansas City about the design of trucks and with the size of cattle today. And as those cattle go to that lower deck, how many of those are hitting their loins in the round on the top of that truck as they're going to that lower deck? There was a discussion about redesigning trucks, and apparently there are some people in movement to do that already. Bridget Wasser at NCBA helped Jesse Fulton put together an explanation of what does this mean from an impact standpoint. If you have one load of 36 head and you have one bruise on both loins, that's going to cost a producer about $1,200, given the price of cattle, because you have to trim that loss. If you have two loins that have an extreme bruise, meaning we're losing the value of those loins completely, we're losing about $13,000. So that just puts it in perspective, the value of bruises. When we look at off-fall condemnations, we have a dramatic increase in liver condemnations from 2011 to 2016. So from 20 to 30% livers were condemned. When you look at why, most of that is liver abscesses, and very few are liver flukes. Some of it's contamination, which you can't control, right? So if that animal's headed down the gut table and something gets busted, that whole viscera is condemned, so we aren't going to be able to save that liver. So that's not a producer error. That's not a producer fault. You can't solve that issue, but that's where it's coming from. When we go into the cooler, we're doing this typically on a different day's production. And so looking at breed type, we do see an increase from 2000 to 2016 up to 16% dairy that we see in the cooler. And so that is important. We're going to talk about that in a minute. Carcass weight has increased over time. So this gives you every one of our fed beef audits. 1991, we were at 760 pounds. We're up to 860 pounds, average hot carcass weight. When we look at that distribution, you can see, I mentioned that we were giving space for a 1,000-pound animal. We have over 12% carcasses in this audit that are 1,000 pounds or more. Very few are under the 600-pound limit that we had as a concern when you did the original audit in 1991. Change in prime and choice over time from 91 to 2016, so started at 55%. Granted, there's some grade changes in here, but up to over 70% prime and choice. When we look at just prime, we're up to almost 4%. Now, I mentioned I'd bring the dairy carcasses back into it. Dairy carcasses tend to grade easier than native beef type animals. And so that increase to 16% dairy is going to drive some of that increase in prime. When we look at yield grade 4s and 5, you can see that's been sporadic over time. In 2016, 14.5%. When we look at averages, native versus dairy, USDA yield grade 3.1 versus a 3.0, you have a big difference in fat thickness of 6/10 versus 36/100. Carcass weight, 15 pounds difference between the two groups. Ribeye area, 1.5 inches difference. Marbling scores to the advantage of the dairy. But with more with a higher marbling score, smaller ribeyes, it's easier to get that distribution that they're looking for in the grading. When we look at these traits over time, so 1991 audit to 2016, you can see we really haven't changed yield grade very much. It's been a 3.2 down to a 2.8 the entire time. We've seen quality grade change, so those are marbling scores. You've seen fat thickness remain pretty stable. The difference is hot carcass weight and ribeye area. So we've increased hot carcass weight 100 pounds. We've increased ribeye area by a square inch. We also have a unique perspective in this recent audit that we have 4.5 million data points for instrument grading assessment. So we had 5 different companies from 18 plants agree to give us 1 week's worth of instrument grading information for each of their plants for each month, January through December in 2016. And so we can look at some neat types of data with that snapshot. So we can look at dark cutters by month. We've always talked about on the meat side of things that we have an increase in dark cutters as we hit that first cold snap. And this shows you that that actually is true, right? We have an increase. Granted, it's a small increase because you're still less than 1%, but to 0.7% in September and October. And so we see that increase. But the neat thing to look at from this data is we have our 9,000 data points in the cooler and our 4.5 million data points on instrument grading, and the USDA yield grade is the same. Fat thickness is 0.02 difference. Carcass weight, 7 pounds. Ribeye area, 0.1 square inch. And marbling score, 0.05. So a small 70 to a small 75. You couldn't put a group of expert graders together and have them get this close. And so our snapshot that we do actually gives us a very good perspective of what's going on in the industry. When we move into the in-plant assessment for cows and bulls, this is a snapshot of where we were for those plants. Same type of data we're going to collect. So we have a difference in miles traveled for cows and bulls. We were at 870 for a max on fed steers and heifers. We have cows and bulls that are traveling over 1,400 miles to get to a cow plant. And so we're going to have some differences in terms of mobility. We're going to have some slight differences in terms of bruises given that. We're giving them a little more, square footage up to 12.4, but still that's the amount of space you're expected for a 1,000-pound animal. So when we look at, we do a lot more things in the holding pens with cows and bulls than we do for fed steers and heifers because there's some more visual defects that we can look at. When we just look at percentage of cattle considered sound, the one thing you can point out is that on dairy cows in 2016, we saw a big improvement in dairy cow productivity, if you will, in terms of healthiness as those animals get to the plant. So only 51% of dairy cows were sound in 2007, and that's up to 76%. We also look at muscle score and condition in the holding pens. And so on a scale of 1 to 5 for muscle scores. And so these are the percent that are too light, so 1s and 2s. So we'd like to see these percentages going down. And they have in beef cows, only 35% are too light muscled. Dairy cows, that is up to 93, 94%. But I will preface that with, do you really expect dairy cows to have more muscle than that given their production and what you're expecting them to do? Probably not. So not a huge concern. We do have a slight increase in bulls, beef bulls, and a decrease in dairy bulls in terms of the percentage that are too light muscled. We also look at those that are too thin. So on the body condition score, this would be a score of 1 or 2 for beef cows, 1 or 1.5 on dairy cows being a scale of 1 to 5. So we see a decrease in all the cows in terms of those that are considered too thin, so not enough condition. An increase in bulls up to 5.7%, so not real dramatic, and only just under 1% of dairy bulls that are considered too thin when they're going to market. Percentage of cattle with no defect. So most of our cows, 72% of our cows are good, beef cows, 56% of dairy cows, 68% of beef bulls, and 76% of dairy bulls were considered sound or didn't have a defect visual in the holding pens at all. So what defects are we observing? We can look at bottle teats. This line that you see, so this is beef cows and dairy cows in the light colored. The lines that you see is where that percentage was in the 2007 audit, just so you can see a comparison. So we've decreased the frequency of bottle teats in dairy cows, which is good. Failed suspensory ligaments, full bags, mastitis, those types of udder problems that we can look at in cows. Chances are some of those, that's why they were culled. And so you're going to expect some of those problems to be seen. You'll never see those quite get to zero. We also look at mud prevalence. Mud prevalence, we realize, can be a system or an impact of season and what conditions, weather conditions are like. And so you're going to see a lot more variability with this as we go from one year in the audit to another. But we do see an increase in those that had no mud presence or manure presence on the hide when they got to the plant. Brand, we know that we have brand laws in states and that you're never going to change those, but it's still important to talk about the value of hides. And when those animals are branded with their name, address, and phone number, maybe we can find a way to decrease the number or decrease the size or change the area. If there is a rib brand, it's hard for a hide manufacturer to really get a value out of that hide. You guys might be interested in having your brand on a truck seat or on a couch or whatever. The normal everyday consumer is not. And so that's where those become an issue. And so not really going to throw out numbers in terms of an issue or where we should be, but throwing out how those things have changed over time. Bruise severity. The good news on bruise severity is that we've seen a huge decrease in the frequency of critical and extreme bruises in cows and bulls. We still only see about 35 to 36% of cows and 57% of bulls without a bruise. And so we have some improvement that we can do on handling and bruising, but the frequency of those that are an issue and that those that might be severe enough to lead to condemnations, those have decreased dramatically. When we look overall in terms of the bruises that we do see, a vast majority of those in all groups are minimal bruises, so requiring less than a pound of trim. And we can look at where, and that varies. A lot of them are on the loin and the round, which is part of actually loading them on a truck and transportation. Condemnations, we see a decrease in tongue condemnations. We've seen an increase in liver condemnations from 99, but remaining pretty stable to what they were in 2007. And we see an increase of fetal presence in 2016. The only reason we look at fetal presence is because that fetal blood has a huge value to a packer. It's actually one of the largest value items besides the carcass itself that a packer has if a cow is pregnant when it gets to the plant. They will collect that fetal blood and sell it to the pharmaceutical market. And so we do look at that. We realize that sometimes that's good for that cow to go while she's still alive, and you may not be able to hold her over till she calves. But if we have those late fetuses, which about 47% of those were what we classified as late fetuses, could that cow have made it to calving? We don't know, but it's just something to think about from a production standpoint. We were also able to throw in with the audit as kind of a side project an update with the injection site lesion presence for cows and bulls. This hadn't been done since 2000, so we did a subset of the plants that we looked at for phase two, went to each of those plants and sliced 200 beef rounds, and dairy cow rounds to look for the presence of injection site lesions. Looking at 670 beef rounds, only 7% had an injection site lesion present. Only 14%, almost 15% of dairy rounds had an injection site lesion present. And the maximum lesions had decreased to 2 and 4 respectively. When we did these, I actually did these as a graduate student the last time they were done. When we did those, we were seeing up to 12 injection site lesions in a cow round on the dairy side, and so that's huge improvement. And you can see that improvement over time. Those used to be done on an annual basis in the late 90s, early 2000. And you can see we've come from an original number of 60% in dairy cows, 31% beef cows, down to 15 and 7% respectively. So into the cooler for cows, we also look at muscle scores, same 5-point scale, and I only throw this up there to show you that it matches really well what we see in the holding pins, so not much difference. We do have a frequency of those that are light muscled being a 1 and a 2, and so we have some improvement we can make, but at least they're not all ones, which is what we saw more of in the late 90s. We also look at yellow fat, because we do have some cow trim that will be thrown in with fed beef trim to make certain types of ground beef. If you get yellow fat that's in this 4, 5, and 6 realm, it will start to change the color of that ground beef as they make that with more yellow fat. And so when they get on that realm, that does cause a discount from a packer perspective. And so we've seen a decrease in those that are 4, 5, and 6 from a yellow fat perspective. We also look at the frequency of arthritic joints. Arthritic joints are an issue because if arthritis is present, that round has to be removed and cannot be used in food production. And so in 1999, when we first looked at those, 11% of cow carcasses had at least one arthritic joint. That is down to 1.3%. So that's a huge improvement. And the last phase is the strategy workshop. How do you round this information out, and what take-home message can you have for producers? So in December of last year, we invited about 70 participants from producers, BQA advisory board members, packers, retail, food service, government agencies to Denver to hear all the results from phase one and phase two, and to prioritize what the plan is for the next 5 years. So from a fed beef perspective, we focused on three things: food safety and animal health, eating quality and reduction of variety, and optimizing value and eliminating waste. So focusing on those things related to quality and value and safety. And so you can read more about those in the executive summary. We also, on the fed steer and heifer side, to calculate at lost opportunities, get those end users to qualify and quantify for us, what is the target consensus? What should we be producing? And they outline that we should be producing 5% prime, 35% upper two-thirds choice, 35% low choice, and 25% select. That is what they could market. Same on yield grade, 10% yield grade ones, 45% yield grade twos, 40% yield grade threes, 5% yield grade fours. Packers are like, we really don't want any yield grade fours, but we realize there's a few of those. If you feed them to yield grade four, you'll actually move them up the grading scale. And so they'll accept a few. And weight, they really prefer not to have anything over 1,000 pounds. Granted, that goes against efficiency, and it might even go against what the grids actually say, but it becomes a challenge to market those in a consistency basis for retail and food service. So when we look at that consensus and compare that to what we're actually producing in phase two, we calculate that we're losing about $49 for every steer and heifer harvested due to quality defects that we found during the fed beef quality audit. We do the same type of thing for cows and bulls. So we don't have three nice little target areas. We just have a mix of things in terms of timely marketing of cows and bulls. So we realize there may be some quality defects that are sending them to market, making sure they're sent and mobile to be sent and able to be transported before they're sent 1,200, 1,400 miles on a truck. Changes to placement and size of brands if possible. Appropriate injection site placement. We've done a good job on that, continuing that. Greater coordination between the vets and producers to ensure promotion of beef quality assurance principles. More effective communication with those that transport about their right to refuse transporting if they don't think that animal will make it the distance they need to be hauled, and remaining diligent in education of BQA principles. We also do a lost opportunities for cows and bulls. I will admit that it's a little more fuzzy math, because some of these things, it's hard to put a value on. Condemnations are easy because you have the value of those byproducts, and we've seen byproduct values increase since the last cow audit. Part of those are easy because we know how much rounds are worth. Part of them get a little more difficult in terms of yellow fat, dark cutters, inadequate muscling, and excess fat, because you're not going to hold an animal over to put more muscle on because you're going to get them to harvest before they're non-ambulatory and have to be put down. And so it's not perfect, but we estimate $122 lost due to quality defects. Before I round this out, I want to make sure you realize that this is not just a Oklahoma State or Texas A&M or one institution to pull this project off. It's multiple individuals, multiple people. One group in a plant could be anywhere from 6 to 12 individuals to capture the data, so I just want to give them credit. We also utilize USDA AMS to call factors when we're in the fed steer and heifer plants, and so everyone was very valuable in getting that project done. But here's why we do it. Because some of you might be asking, well, why do we continue to do it every 5 years for 25 years when not a lot's changed? And we heard that from some of our BQA coordinators in terms of there's no real bright, shining star for a take-home message. But sometimes doing one thing 1% better makes a huge improvement over time. And so we've seen, if you go back to the original 91 audit, and there were one of the big issues out of there was injection site lesions. And so that became one of the big targets of beef quality assurance education. And you saw fed injection site lesions in top sirloin butts go from 22 to 2.5%. We've seen cow and bull lesions go from 16 and 31 to 15 and 7 with producer education. And so we've utilized all that information and the concept of total quality management and the philosophy of the lost opportunities to change and add to our beef quality assurance program and producer education. So it all goes back to this concept. Is there one thing that as a producer, you can spend $1 in time and effort to prevent that defect happening at the plant? There's some defects, if they arrive at the plant, they might cost us $10 to fix, but there's some defects, if they get to a consumer, may cost us $100 to fix. And so it's understanding the right mentality behind it. So you saw a dead cat from Matt earlier. I'm giving you, I don't know what it is, but it's the winner of the Arizona Department of Transportation Not My Job Award. Those guys did their job. And so you might think, well, I'm doing my job, but is there one thing that could take just a little bit of time or effort different and you could have a higher valued product in the end for a consumer? And your consumer, your customer might actually be the feedlot or it might be the packer or who knows who your customer is, but can we do one thing different, make quality product a little bit better for the next guy down the road? So with that, I'm going to point you to www.bqa.org if you want the full executive summaries. They are there for you to get. The short executive summaries for cows and bulls and fed steers and heifers are there as well as several state coordinators are in the room, I know, and they have slide decks available to them. Jesse Fulton with NCBA is here if you have BQA questions or how we can get the information out. But I'm happy to turn it over or answer questions, whatever the case may be.